Moscow denounces what it calls U.S. peak hysteria surrounding Ukraine after President Joe Biden warned of decisive response if Russia invades Ukraine. French police fired tear gas at demonstrators in Paris shortly after people protesting COVID restrictions entered the city in defiance of a police ban. And truckers blocking a key bridge between Canada and the U.S. over vaccination rules defy orders to leave. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning into the World News. Moscow has denounced what it calls Washington's peak hysteria over Ukraine, says warnings of an imminent Russian invasion on its western neighbor have reached absurd levels. This comes following a phone call between Russian and U.S. presidents, where Joe Biden pledged a swift and direct response by the U.S. and its allies if Russia attacks Ukraine. Putin also criticized the U.S. for failing to address his country's security concerns. Russia has repeatedly dismissed allegations that it is preparing to invade Ukraine. It has, however, demanded an end to NATO's eastward expansion and a ban on Kiev's admission to the military alliance. Meanwhile, Ukraine itself has denounced the hype about a looming Russian attack.
I have to speak with our people like, like president and say people truth, and the truth that we have different information. And now the best friend for enemies, that is panic in our country. And all this information that helps only for panic doesn't help us.
Zelensky also demanded any solid evidence of an imminent invasion. Several countries, including the US, the UK, Germany, Sweden, Japan, and Saudi Arabia, have called on their citizens to leave the country immediately. The US State Department has even ordered its non-emergency embassy staff in Ukraine to leave. Pentagon also says it is withdrawing nearly half all of its remaining soldiers, that is, from Ukraine. Amid rising tensions between Moscow and Washington, the Russian military said a U.S. submarine violated its waters near the Kuril Islands in the Far East as Russia was conducting naval exercises. The military said that it used appropriate means to make the intruding vessel leave after it ignored a request. Russia's defense ministry has summoned the U.S. military attaché over the incident. Political commentator John Bosnich says Russia has reiterated it is not planning on invading Ukraine, and if the U.S. and the West are worried about an invasion, they need to provide evidence for such concern.
There's no justification for statements about an attack coming in 1 hour or 3 hours or tomorrow afternoon or anything like that. If this is what the United States and its NATO allies are trying to do, to incite fear in their own populations, then that's what they're achieving. But of that fear, nothing good can come. Russia has been making it very, very clear that they're not planning to invade. If the West is that worried about an invasion, then maybe they should prove the evidence that they're using to make those claims. The people of the region on both sides are all the victims of a current pre-warfare psychological operations. But the far more damaging and unsettling operation is the one being conducted by the United States and its NATO allies, who are goading the war on, who are threatening a war at any moment, and yet saying that they will not intervene in any way. So these elements are definitely stoking the fires of war. And since war is the main business for most of the NATO countries, the military-industrial complex is the main business, then they're just stoking the fires of their own economy at the expense of the Russians and of the Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainians and ethnic Russians in the country of Ukraine.
And now welcome everyone to our News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The United States says it will reopen its embassy on the Solomon Islands as Washington seeks to expand its presence in the Pacific region. Washington has not had an embassy there since 1993 and is represented by a consulate, which is directed from the U.S. Embassy in Papua New Guinea. Senior U.S. officials have said the move is aimed at countering China's growing influence in the Pacific. They say Beijing plans to forge military ties in the region. In December, China said it'll send police advisors and non-lethal gear to the Solomon Islands following deadly riots a month earlier. The U.S. Secretary of State is now in Fiji for talks with regional leaders. Washington is promising more diplomatic and security sources to Pacific nations. Joining us now is Andrew Lang, independent China specialist from Hong Kong, for more on the story, along with Mr. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well, both of you. I guess we'll start there in Hong Kong with you, Mr. Lang. Tell us what the U.S. is trying to do with its increasing presence in the Pacific.
I think there is a perception that China, quite unlike the past century, is now growing in global influence. It's expanding its influence around the world, competing with the United States' global reach. Secondly, the global China's global reach is now encroaching on the United States' traditional sphere of influence, including its backyard. For example, recently, even Argentina in South America has joined the Belt and Road Initiative. Apart from China's diplomatic and other economic relations with a number of South African countries, and now the Asia Pacific has felt that China's influence is growing. Thirdly, China is now competing not only with the United States in economics, on the military, South China Sea, but also increasingly in soft power. The Beijing Olympics, the Winter Olympics and the Beijing Olympics, Summer Olympics were examples. And of course, the Solomon Island, unlike the United States, China is not prepared or is not able to replicate the Americans' global reach, Americans' military bases in many, many countries around the world. There's no sense that China would repeat that. But by growing its influence in the Asia-Pacific, along with the Belt and Road, along with investments, or given police help, it also strokes the kind of feeling that China's approach is very different. Americans' approach is all military, coercion, sanctions, and trying to force or coerce other countries to play to Americans' hymn book. But whereas China is now adopting a different softer power, a kind of win-win approach. Last but not least, it seems that the United States is beginning to react rather than taking the initiative as the global power. That only gives the impression that Americans' hegemony dominance is declining. For example, it's reacting to China's Belt and Road in terms of the Build Back Better, and now it's now trying to reestablish consulates or embassies in a number of countries.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. William Jones, thanks for your patience. Always a pleasure to check in with you, sir. Your thoughts, what's the Washington's rule here, Mr. Jones, that you can be nowhere in our neighborhood, but we could be in your backyard when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China?
Well, Secretary Blinken went to Asia with was a document that was released by the White House yesterday on the Indo-Pacific strategy. And if you looked at this in detail, it's really a declaration of empire. It's worded in, of course, different terms, talking about their alliances and their similarity in values, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially, it's telling the Asia-Pacific powers that that we are the big cheese in the Asia-Pacific, and you've got to ally with us if you really want to go anywhere. They have nothing to offer them except military equipment, similar to what was done with the AUKUS, but they also have to say certain things about that they also will do infrastructure, they also will send their vaccines. They're really following in China's wake on all of these issues in order to try and regain some credibility in the region. But the attitude that they have is that this is effectively, the world is effectively something like a Roman Empire, and the center of that empire is in Washington, and that they make the rules, and they set the criteria for what the world has to do. Essentially, Blinken, the setting up of an embassy in the Fiji Islands after all these years is more like setting up a liaison office with a satrap that can do the will of the United States. The Solomon Islands, of course, are not so important economically, but they have recognized Beijing and do not recognize Taiwan. And there's a game going on here where the U.S. wants to pressure them to switch to Taiwan. Taiwan, which, of course, is no country, but which is a kind of the remnant of a civil war where the defeated power ended up in, but was proclaimed a government by the United States as a means against China, is trying to regain status. And even the smaller countries in that respect are important. I think the United States move to the Fiji Islands was an attempt to try and shift the gears towards Taiwan with regard to that. But the whole thing is an imperial policy. It's not going to work. The United States cannot compete with China in terms of a Belt and Road Initiative. They don't build infrastructure. They don't build infrastructure in the United States, and they certainly won't be building it in the Fiji Islands. So it's really a bluff. And most of the nations that they're going to who have experienced the effects of China's Belt and Road Initiative, which was really a historic turning point for the world, I don't think they're going to buy into the line that the U.S. is pushing, because they know the reputation of the United States.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Always a pleasure to speak to both of you. Andrew Lang from Hong Kong and Mr. William Jones joining us from the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. And welcome back, everyone. France's yellow vests have led an anti-government freedom convoy to Paris, taking a page out of the book of protesters in Canada. However, Paris responded with an immediate crackdown, and it's still unclear if France's freedom convoy is done or just begun. Rami Mazahiri has your story.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy, emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019. Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A standoff between Canadian police and anti-vaccine protesters continues in the capital, Ottawa, Authorities say those who do not respect the rule of law will get arrested. Warning comes hours after the start of an operation led by police to end protesters' blockade on Ambassador Bridge. That's the country's busiest border crossing with the U.S. Truckers have cut access to three vital Canadian U.S. crossings in protest at the government's COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. Presidents of the U.S. and Canada have called for an end to the blockade, and a judge in Canada has ruled accordingly. Canadian officials say security officers have been deployed to some other areas as well, including the city of Toronto and the province of New Brunswick, to avoid similar unrest. And thousands of Venezuelans hit the streets of the capital, Caracas, to voice support for President Nicolas Maduro. Demonstrators chanted pro-government slogans and carried photos of Maduro. They marched on a 14-kilometer course to mark World Youth Day, which traditionally brings out all Venezuelan parties to the streets. Opposition figure Juan Guaido also attended a small gathering of Venezuelan opposition and delivered a speech. Talks between Iran and P4+1 group of countries continues in Vienna as sides intensify efforts to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Head of the Chinese delegation says there is consensus that the negotiations are heading into final stages. Wang Kun says Iran has presented its final proposition to other parties. A source close to the talks has told Press TV that Tehran views the act of exchanging proposals normal practice in any negotiation. Source says Iran has put forward new ideas on the table and is encouraging other parties to do the same. Source also told us that Tehran has a clear mandate in the Vienna talks and that developments outside the scope of the negotiations will not have any effect on Tehran's stance. Iran and the remaining parties to the agreement are conducting an eighth round of discussions in the Austrian capital aimed at reviving the JCPOA. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and deaths of civilians, especially children. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Batinga Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Sanctions Caused Mass Civilian Deaths in Iraq. Afghan civilians are up next. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. A report by the UN Commission on Human Rights studying the impact of the sanctions on Iraq estimated the civilian death toll to be in the range from 500,000 to 1.5 million, with the majority of the dead being children. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was confronted with this shocking statistic on 60 Minutes, which led to this now infamous exchange. During this era of sanctions, then-Senator Joe Biden was a member and eventually chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Biden strongly supported sanctions and advocated for even more aggressive policies toward Iraq. Biden was not then and is not now known for his humanitarian impulses or dovish foreign policy stances. The same cannot be said for Samantha Power. Power is the current head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, who was brought into the Biden administration to be a champion of human rights, lifting up the vulnerable and ushering in a new era of human progress and development, according to Biden's nomination statement. Power was the founding director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, served as the Obama administration's UN ambassador, and has a long list of human rights accolades. The nomination of this human rights crusader, as Politico put it, was widely praised in the human rights community, yet Power's record on U.S. imposed sanctions, first in scholarship and then practice, is abysmal. In her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide describes the U.S. response to genocides of the 20th century, arguing that U.S. power should have been used to prevent atrocities and protect civilians. In the chapter surveying the 1990s, Power condemns the Clinton administration's failure to intervene in Rwanda, intervene soon enough in the Balkans, and use U.S. military force to curb atrocities elsewhere. Yet the U.S. sanctions regime that caused mass devastation to Iraqi civilians was conspicuously absent. It does not get a single mention in the book. Power's silence on the hundreds of thousands of children dead from U.S. sanctions is telling. Power is unrelenting, and rightfully so, in her condemnation of human rights abuses carried out by other countries. Yet even though the death toll of the U.S.-imposed sanctions rivaled or even exceeded the contemporaneous atrocities and genocides Power depicted in her book, when the U.S. was the perpetrator, she was silent. Unfortunately, her silence on sanctions and their devastating human consequences persist. Power, as administrator of USAID, is now an active participant in the starvation of Afghan civilians. In response to the pleas from the UN and humanitarian organizations working in Afghanistan, USAID increased humanitarian aid. But, as experts have noted, meagerly increasing aid while imposing devastating sanctions and freezing nearly all of Afghanistan's foreign assets will do nearly nothing to stop the unprecedented level of economic shock. There is near consensus among numerous humanitarian coordinators that the only way to curb the collapse of Afghanistan's economy and prevent furthering the major humanitarian disaster already underway is to lift the sanctions. Unfortunately, Power, the so-called defender of human rights, refuses to call for a lifting of the sanctions and instead remains uncritical. The devastating human toll of sanctions on Iraqi civilians in the 90s is a grim warning for what lies ahead if current U.S. policy continues. The Clinton administration sanctions caused mass death and suffering, and the Biden administration is dangerously close to falling in their footsteps. The human rights hawks, who lamented the humanitarian consequences of the fall of Kabul, are now silent in the face of U.S.-imposed mass starvation, and the human rights crusader within the administration is complicit. We must listen to the chorus of humanitarian organizations and pressure the Biden administration to immediately lift the sanctions before it is too late. Afghans have suffered at the hands of U.S. for long enough.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite figure who spent most of his life regarding the field of Islamic hikmah or philosophy. Of course, philosophy in the Western term and hikmah in the Eastern Islamic terms are two different fields of studies, but he is mainly known as the Shiite philosopher and faqih of contemporary Iran, the late Ayatollah Mahdi Hayri Yazdi, the son of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Mahdi Hayri Yazdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sheikh Mehdi Hayri Yazdi is the son of the grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, the establisher of the Islamic Seminary of Qom. And Sheikh Mehdi Hayri Yazdi was born in 1923 in Qom, and he started his Islamic studies in the city of Qom under the supervision of his father. He had different teachers in Qom, like late Ayatollah Hujjat Kuh Kamari or Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khansari Rahmatullah Alay, and even Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alay and Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani, that these two late figures are his professors in philosophy and hikmat.
That's right.
Late Sheikh Mehdi Hayri Yazdi is known because of his studies in philosophy. Of course, he was a prominent scholar in fiqh and usul, in jurisprudence and its, you know, basics. But he is famous because of his works and studies in Islamic philosophy and even Western philosophy.
That's right.
And the point that he starts, you know, studying philosophy and teaching philosophy in a way that be a figure, a world figure regarding this, is that from the moment that he is sent to United States by late Ayatollah Burujerdi Rahmatullah Alay, who was the grand marja at that time.
That's right.
And late Ayatollah Burujerdi sent some, you know, representatives to different countries, yes, like Hijaz, like, you know, Africa, like England, like Germany, and also United States. That Sheikh Mehdi Hayri is sent to United States, and when he enters the United States, he decides to have some preaching regarding Islamic studies, and he finds out that he need to get familiar with the culture and with the academic language of the society, so mm-hmm. that he enters the university
okay.
in bachelor degree and MA, and then even in PhD degree that he participated in Toronto University of Canada.
Yes. So Georgetown University was the university you studied in. Georgetown,
yes, in
yes.
bachelor.
Bachelor,
in
yes.
bachelor, but
yes.
the PhD was Toronto University in Canada.
Okay.
So beside studying philosophy in these universities, started teaching there, and besides, you know, having these courses at university, he had his activities in Muslim society in the United States of America.
That's all right. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, the main field of study of Mahdi Hariri Yazdi is philosophy. Let's differentiate between the philosophy and the hikmah, these two, different fields of studies. Because from one side, he's becoming familiar with the philosophy in the Western fashion and the Western tradition. And from the other side, he is the son of one of the greatest ulama. He is a Rouhani himself, wearing turban, an imama, and this cleric robe here and there. And has studies on Mullah Sadra, and other fields of study. It becomes really difficult for a teacher or for a master or a professor regarding academic studies to have mastery over both of them, the Western philosophy and the Eastern one. How did he manage this field of study?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you said, it's 2-4 different fields of study. When any student of seminary school enters the seminary, after participating for some years, he is facing 2-4 different, you may say it, 2-4 different sections, either to take the field of study of Manqul or what has something to do with the ahadith and traditions and narrations, and other field of study which has something to do with the Ma'qul. Philosophy, Kalam, and the other things must be categorized under this field of study. But it's really interesting that when it comes to Ayatollah Sheikh Mehdi Hariri Yazdi, we see that he had mastery over both field of study, as we see that in his academic career, this is mentioned that he was teaching Kifayatul Usul, which is regarded as one of the top lessons in Usul al-Fiqh and or let's say principle of jurisprudence of Shia. So for someone to teach this and at the same time you see that he has entered philosophy and mastered philosophy and hikmah, and when he moves to United States, as my brother mentioned, and in Canada, he graduated from McGill University and Toronto University.
Yes.
So he is capable to teach both field of studies in different universities of the West. Right. So in Michigan University, in as it is said in Howard University, he has been teaching fiqh, he has been teaching philosophy, he has been teaching Persian literature and other field of studies that it is really difficult for normal individual, normal students to get mastery over.
Also analytical philosophy, which is a field very much related to the Western fashion and Western tradition of the philosophy, was taught by him, in the Western universities, and shows his mastery over.
Yeah, he has a very big academic career, as it is said, to teach philosophy in Montreal University, Oxford University, in New York, in Yale University, he was teaching philosophy. So this is not easy. Although he was not employed in these universities as a faculty member, but to be qualified to the extent that you get invitation to go there as a visiting professor to teach these subjects, it's really difficult, and better to say it's kind of dream for normal students of Hausa or seminary students.
Also philosophy of ethics at the Toronto University, which is really an interesting field of study. Okay, Sheikh Ziyania, one of the controversial issues addressed by Mahdi Hariri Yazdi is regarding the concept of hukuma, or the authority, okay? So he brings this concept under the shadow of the concept of wakala, or deputyship, isn't it? And not the wilaya, or the guardianship. What's your take on that? Of course, there were so many, criticism writing on that by Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, Ayatollah Mu'min, and the other people, Sayyid Abbas Husseini Ghaib Maqami, and the other ones, writes, and he answered them in an answered and question way. There were so rebuttals. What's your commentary on his view, brother?
If we want to go deep into this subject, we should trace back the origin of authenticity in Islamic resources, that the authenticity and, you know, governorship in Muslim society is belong to whom? According to majority of Muslim scholars, the authenticity and governance in Muslim society belongs to Allah, Almighty God, in origin.
Yes.
And by His hand, I mean by His, you know, permission, it's gifted to a Holy Prophet and, you know, his successors that are Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam.
That's right.
So this governance is wilayat. You know, wilayat is not something different from governance.
Yes.
They have authority,
yes,
to give orders, and people should accept these orders.
Okay.
But the problem is regarding the occultation period.
The Asr al-Ghaybah.
Yes, Asr al-Ghaybah. That in this period, because we don't have access, you know, directly to Imam, so, but we need government in the society. So if we have a Muslim country and the government is the hand of a Muslim governor, should we count him as a just governor that is given permission by Almighty Allah? Or no, we should count him as a person who is an oppressor and who has usurped position of governance. So this is a critical question,
yes,
that scholars try to answer. Some of which, like Imam Khomeini and some other scholars, they believe that, okay, at this era even, we need to have a person who is a prominent scholar, and this scholar is gifted by Almighty God through the chain that we mentioned.
That's
that
right.
It's gifted to Holy Prophet, okay, to Ahlul Bayt, and then at That's the occultation right. time, because we don't have direct access to Imam, so a closer person, mm-hmm, who is a faqih,
yes,
a prominent faqih,
yes,
must be at that position.
This is the velaya-based theory of,
yes,
governance or authority.
Yes.
Now, what is the vakala one? Because Mahdi Hayri Yazdi was the supporter of the vakala,
yeah,
one. Okay.
Mahdi Hayri Yazdi and some others, even we have some other figures, they say that no, the authenticity at the time of occultation belongs to people.
Okay.
Not to faqih.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, it belongs to people, and people are the ones who are choosing some, you know, figures to rule over their society.
Okay.
So if the faqih is there,
mm-hmm,
so it must have the permission of people.
People. Okay.
So.
So if either this permission is by voting or something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So even, you know, through the acceptance by society, maybe there is no election, but, mm-hmm, people are accepting him,
yes,
by their hearts, and they are following his,
yes,
orders. If it is like this,
yes,
so the governance is acceptable,
yes,
and his orders is accepted, but up to the point that people accept,
yes,
him. If,
yes,
they reject him,
yes,
he is basically,
okay,
resigned.
Mm-hmm.
But in the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih, if,
yes,
people do not accept a person, he is not basically resigned.
That's right.
But again, he will give up the government,
that's
to,
right,
people. He won't kill the people because,
okay,
of governing over,
yes,
them. He will resign and stand aside. But they say, the people who believe in the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih, they say that, again, he is at that position.
Yes.
But because people are not listening to him,
okay,
he is not in a position to, you know, give instructions.
Yes.
But he is, again, at that position. The same thing that we are saying at the time of the caliphate of the first and second and,
yes,
third caliph, that,
okay,
we say that Imam Ali alayhi salam was at the
position of the
but
imamate.
He had no, you know, they were not listening to him.
Okay.
So this is the difference, that whether basically faqih is at that situation with the permission of people or with the permission of God.
Of God. So from one side, in the velaya-based authority or velayat al-faqih, the legitimacy comes straight from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Prophet Muhammad, infallible imams, and at the time of the occultation, he is the representative of, it's better to say, this velaya system giving authority. But in the vakala system, you know, the population, the people, and the legitimacy is over there.
And there are some problems regarding the vakala system. For example, who gives this authority to people?
Mm-hmm.
And if we believe like this, so why the people are not having this authority at the time of the Holy Prophet?
Okay.
So we should answer these critical questions.
But the case is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran system, which is based on Velayat al-Faqih now, the case is that the people at first hand
vote for the members of Majlis Khobregan or the elite assembly, okay, of the leadership. And based on their opinions, the next leader or the Vali Faqih of Iran is going to be chosen. So at the same time, it is somehow based in the legitimacy of the votes of the people too, isn't it?
Yeah, this is kind of...
But the selection of Vali Faqih is based upon the knowledge of those members of the assembly.
So it shows that this is not directly anymore, as my brother mentioned.
Okay.
At the system of Vekala, it is directly upon the wish or will of the people.
People, that's right.
So from tomorrow, if they decided to withdraw or take their vote back, so the system is not going to operate anymore.
Okay.
With or relying on that person who had been chosen as the governor. This is based on the system of Vekala. But in Islamic Republic of Iran, we are benefiting from the system which was a kind of merging between these two things.
Okay.
So we have people on one hand, and on the other hand, we see that still this authenticity comes through Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because we say that people are going to vote in favor of their representative, who are going to gather together in the elite assembly, which is Majlis Khobregan.
Yes.
And those people must be qualified of some certain qualifications. They must be faqih.
Yes.
Meaning jurists.
Yes.
They must be mujtahid.
Yes.
They must be just. They must be expert and having expertise in different field of study of Islam. So
they have the power in order to recognize who would be the true manifestation or spiritual actualization of the theory of Walayat al-Faqih, that is Wali of the society, isn't it?
Yes. Then that in the elite assembly, which is Majlis Khobregan, these representative of people, they will gather together and sit, having their meeting, their discussions, and coming to this point that this person is qualified to lead and govern over the people.
Over the people.
And after choosing one person, they keep monitoring him. This is not to say, okay, if someone is chosen, they keep monitoring him based on keeping with the lines of Islam.
Okay. Yes.
This is also is not based on the wish.
That's right.
That, okay, since this person is not keeping with our wish, so we are going to put him aside. No, they are going to supervise his actions and activities based on the Islamic standards.
That's right. But the Vekala system is also in the Islamic Republic of Iran by selecting the president of Iran, isn't it? It is upon the direct wish of the people who to select, not to select.
In Islamic Republic of Iran, as Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, you know, we have a mixed type of these two, you know, different ideas, ideologies. For example, the president is chosen directly by people.
Yes.
But you know that president is gifted the authenticity by the Wali Faqih.
Yes.
So these are combined to each other.
The legitimate, you know, power and permission is given by the rahbah.
Yeah. So, but executive power, is in the hand of the President, and he is chosen by people. Yes, so Wali Faqih is giving this legitimacy to him, and then the country is ruled by people again.
That's all right. This was, in fact, an analysis, or as better say, a commentary and answer to some of the questions or better ideas posed by Mahdi Hayri as the one of the most outstanding, you know, philosophers of contemporary Iran.
And we should know that this discussion has different aspects. We didn't mention all of them. We just talked about some very, you know,
limited parts
of it.
Of this part. And as I said, there were also so many answers by Ayatollah Javadi Omali, Ayatollah Mo'min, and so many of others. You know, if people are interested, they can refer to the texts which are available you know, on the websites, different websites over there. This outstanding man passed away in 1999. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Masuma in the city of Qom, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless his soul. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, thank you very much.
You're most welcome, brother.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com / Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parsetoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A new analysis says from Germany to the United States, Australia to Italy, the cost of living is rising to new highs and causing new hardships. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Dominic Rush, Kate Connolly, Angela Giuffrida, Peter Hannum, and Hannah Ellis Peterson. The piece is titled The Rise in Global Inflation, The Hit to Living Standards Across the World. Please stay with us for more. After decades lurking in the shadows, inflation is back. On Amazon, you can find fridge magnets printed with words spoken 40 years ago by Ronald Reagan before the election that swept him into the White House. Inflation is as violent as a mugger, as frightening as an armed robber, and as deadly as a hitman. Price spirals remain a real fear for many Americans, particularly those who lived through the double-digit inflation suffered under Ronald Reagan's predecessor Jimmy Carter. What was a painful but distant memory is now a new reality, and it is global. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced on Thursday, 10th of February, that the Consumer Price Index rose year-on-year by 7.5% in January, a level not seen since the 1980s. Britain is not far behind, with prices rising by 5.4% at the end of last year. In the Eurozone, the 19 countries using the euro, it hit 5.1% in January, the highest level since records began in 1997. Here, The Guardian's foreign correspondent reports on how inflation is denting living standards around the world. For years, New Yorkers looking for a cheap eat have been able to rely on a $1 slice of pizza. Not for long, though. As inflation soars, even the cheap slice is under pressure, and many of the city's famous pizza shops are imposing price hikes to combat rising costs for everything from tomato sauce and pepperoni to labour and cardboard pizza boxes. US inflation hit its fastest pace since 1982 in January, pushing prices up at a 7.5% annual rate, the third straight month in which inflation exceeded an annualized rate of 6%. Supply chain issues coupled with rising demand continue to inflate the price of fuel, rent, food and other essentials. According to Cox Automotive, the average price of a used car in the United States was $28,205 at the end of December, the first time the median price of a second-hand vehicle has surpassed $28,000. Price rises have hit everyone, but inflation hits poorer Americans hardest. According to the Labor Department's Consumer Expenditure Survey, the lowest-earning fifth of Americans already spend 83% of their income on housing and can ill afford increase in rents, let alone increase in fuel costs, food, and other essentials. The U.S. Federal Reserve is now preparing to raise interest rates in the hope of taming soaring prices. But with inflation surging worldwide, it remains to be seen how soon or whether the central bank will succeed. Italians have been feeling the knock-on effects of inflation mostly in their utilities bills, with gas and electricity costs rising by more than 50% this winter. In turn, the high energy costs have made it more expensive to run factories and transport goods. Hence, price rises have also been felt in other areas, such as in food prices and price of manufactured goods. Preliminary data from Istat, Italy's statistics agency, earlier this month showed inflation rose by 3.9% during 2021, hitting 4.2% in December, the highest rise in over a decade. The Bank of Italy predicts inflation at 2.8% this year, although businesses are forecasting higher price rises at 3.2%. Italy has not produced nuclear energy for more than three decades and is extremely dependent on energy imports. Marcello Missouri, an economics professor at Lewis University in Rome, said, "We're highly dependent on imported energy, hence why, from this point of view, Italy is more vulnerable than other countries." While forecasting that Europe's green and digital transition plan could impact prices further down the line, he said, "In the short term, there will be a great impact on utilities bills. I'm in favour of the two transitions, but in Europe, we are underassessing the possible medium-term impact." Inflation in Germany is currently around 4.9%, down on December's 5.3%, which was only the second time it has exceeded 5% since reunification of Germany in 1990, and is expected to remain high at least until the middle of the year. The Bundesbank referred to a consistent, extremely high price pressure in its January monthly report. There are multiple reasons behind the inflation rate in Germany, including supply chain issues, price rises to reflect losses linked to the pandemic, high demand for specific goods and services coupled with a labor shortage, as well as a rise in value-added tax rate, VAT rate, after it was temporarily reduced to help businesses last year. The most shocking hikes are for heating bills, petrol prices, diesel, electricity and oil, which according to the Consumer Price Index have increased on average by 18.3%, but in some cases by as much as 50%. On the grocery bill, consumers are paying around 6% more, but with big differences between goods. Potatoes are a big surprise, having risen by around 43% year-on-year, mainly due to bad weather conditions. Other foodstuffs such as tomatoes, salad, milk, onions and eggs have recorded considerable price rises of between 5% and 20%. In general, imports to Germany have increased in price by around 21%, the steepest rise since 1980, mainly due to supply chain issues linked to the coronavirus pandemic. While wages are expected to rise too in Germany, with trade unions insisting on appropriate increases, lower-income families are being hardest hit. Despite a 20% rise in the minimum wage in Germany, many are not expected to feel enough of a lift to be able to make up for the higher cost of living. For a commodity-based economy, Australia faces more of an uphill battle to keep a lid on prices than most. Consumer inflation accelerated at the end of 2021 by 3.5%, while the underlying rate watched by the central bank, the Reserve Bank of Australia, rose to its highest level since mid-2014, at 2.6%. Record-high fuel prices were one factor. The Reserve Bank of Australia's monk-like forbearance to resist lifting the official cash rate from its record low 0.1% until wages start to rise at least 3% annually will be under the spotlight, with financial markets already pricing in the first hike in rates by June. Futures indicate by next February the rate would be as high as 1.25%. A rate rise delay until June, though, would at least avoid embarrassing the federal government in Australia, which must hold a national election on or before 21st of May. Private economists are less hawkish, but doubt that the Reserve Bank of Australia can hold off beyond August. One issue to watch is whether the jobless rate dips below 4%, which would be the lowest since 1974, although there are many reasons why wages growth may remain restrained, including the relatively weak bargaining position of the Labour Party in Australia.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.